and welcome. This is another conversation. I have a special guest here. You're going to have to say your name again for me because I'm
no worries. Sure. It's Muhammad Ali Mujarradi is my real name, like I have on my book. But my online name, Shahrzadeh, struck by the East. So a Westerner who's infatuated with Eastern culture is pronounced Shahrzadeh.
And we're going to be talking a little bit about Iranian culture today. Specifically, we're going to talk about poetry. Before we get going, I'll remind people, pick up a course at the Academic Agency, Trivium, the bestseller. If you're interested in literature, my background, of course, is as a Shakespeare scholar. I've written 6 books now on Shakespeare. My latest one is coming out next month, Foundations of Shakespeare. But you can also pick up the course. If you pick up that course, you can get the book for half price. So check all of that stuff out. You also, if you're interested in any of the stuff we talk about today, you also run courses on poetry and Persian poetry.
I do. Yeah. So all the poets I'll talk about today, I have courses on them online that you're all welcome to check out. Some are in Persian, some are in English, some are bilingual. So there's a broad range of everyone can find something that will fit their needs.
So I'm not an expert on Persian poetry, but one of the things that struck me when I went to Iran 20 odd years ago in 2002, 2003, I remember going to this square. I think it was in Tehran. There's a big square there and they've got all these different statues of various different Persian poets who are, I would say, venerated as national heroes. If I was to outline a kind of big four, it would be, I mean, within Iran, I would say Hafez. My grandfather would often, he'd often be quiet and he'd sit in the corner and then he'd randomly start reciting lines of Hafez just out of which is, again, a culturally unusual thing because people don't tend to like start reciting poetry in this country, but this is something he used to do fairly regularly. And it seems to me that Hafez seems to have this special place. Like every home has got a copy of Hafez or something like this. So he'd be one. Then Ferdowsi, specifically for Shahnameh. You could argue an epic poem that saved Iran as a nation or saved Farsi as a language. How much of this stuff is true and how much is romantic myth? You can debate, but this is the kind of legend of Shahnameh and Ferdowsi. Then Rumi, who for some reason is the one who's become like world famous. He's kind of has best-selling books in America and things like this. So we can talk about possibly why that is. And then the fourth one I would say is Saadi. But I would say in this country, certainly when I was growing up, more famous than him was the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. It had this famous translation by a guy called Fitzgerald in the 19th century. And I think there was a bit of a craze in the Victorian era.
There was. A whole subculture.
Which then carried over. So a lot of people had heard of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, especially a kind of a... There was kind of like an orientalist subcurrent in the 60s or something where some of this stuff came back. Because when I was a kid in the 1980s, sometimes it would be mentioned, you're Iranian, you must know about the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. So it was like one of the things. So I would put as a fifth Omar Khayyam, but there are others too, right? There are other famous. And before I let you come in, I mean, in this country, I mean, I used to have this lecture I used to give on Shakespeare. Right. So, well, the thing about Shakespeare is he is the one writer that every single person has heard of. Okay.
Right.
But stop somebody in the street and you say, well, have you heard of John Milton or William Blake or, I don't know, Shelley or Coleridge or Wordsworth or you name Chaucer or something? Maybe I can't be sure of the answer that's going to come back. Whereas in Iran, all of these people I've just named and a few others as well are household names, and it is kind of kept alive and it's in the culture. Do you think that's fair?
I think it's very fair. And every culture has maybe every form of art, every high culture, every empire, every old civilization has everything. So it's hard to find, you know, Greek, French, Greek, Chinese, European, Roman, South Asian, English, etc. You know, of course they have painting, of course they have poetry, of course they have textiles. Who doesn't have these things? And I don't want to be one of those people who says, you know, in my culture, we love rice and chicken and we have family members and we love gathering with our family together. You wouldn't understand. I don't want to be one of those people. But I think it's not an exaggeration to say that Iranians are the poetry culture of the world. Not to say we have the best or that it's the most insightful or the most influential, but there is no other culture on earth where poetry is as front and center in people's cultural imagination. So this is different than saying we're the best, right? Shakespeare might be better than Hafez. I'm not making that judgment. But we don't have another culture I can think of other than maybe broadly Persianate. So South Asians are influenced, Turks are influenced, where average people, regardless of literacy level, will quote poetry. Poetry is tattooed. It's on walls. It's on cars, on the back. Books are everywhere. People who only own 5 books, 3 of them will be poetry books. Our national identity, as you mentioned, is very much the axis, the center of it. It's very much Ferdowsi's Shahnameh. So more than the Greeks. The Greeks, for example, have this amazing heritage, but how many of them can read and quote it? And the original, maybe an Orthodox priest or some scholar can. You know, the English, they have Shakespeare, but beyond Shakespeare, there isn't much. You know, I have a cursory understanding of the people you name, but even I don't know much about them. So Persians really are a poetry culture. And as much as we love our food and textiles and history, I think if you just had to pick one thing that we've produced that's the best, I would say it's poetry. And it's a shame that there's so little investment in teaching it and learning it, preserving it, not just in Iran, which, you know, we already know our own works, but abroad, right? I don't know, have many peers, I don't think, of people who are involved in trying to get Persian letters known in the world. You mentioned Rumi was a bestseller. That is a recent thing, and it's part of kind of the new age spirituality phenomenon. And Khayyam did have this kind of one-hit wonder cult classic element, but it was a bit of a stroke of genius on Fitzgerald's part. It wasn't that there was some well-established need that was unmet for Eastern poetry. Fitzgerald was just a poetic genius. Of course, it was in that Orientalist milieu. There was that interest in the East for sure. British India was a thing. Brits were going to Iran. The Ottoman Empire was big and strong at some level. So there was part of that. And they did have Khayyam societies that met into the early 20th century, even in New York as well, where people would gather once a year and dress in Oriental costume and read Oriental poetry and compose English poetry that's influenced by it. So I think Iranians would do well to keep that move going. We shouldn't just say, oh, Khayyam and Rumi is enough. We should try to use this as cachet, the same way that the Thai government has food diplomacy. So all the Thai restaurants around the world are actually a government plan, because there's not that many Thai people in the world, right? Or the Italians do food diplomacy as well. And other people have soft power, or political influence. We don't need the food. We don't need the politics. If we just have this as our standard, we go around and say we have this amazing tradition, I think we'll do well for ourselves in terms of getting the world to like us again.
So what is it about Rumi, do you think, that has got people interested now? Why has he become somebody people have heard of? Because I wouldn't sure. say that wasn't true when I was growing up.
You're right. So Persian poetry contains everything. You know, we have books that ruminate on life and death, but then also a whole book of Persian poetry describing clothing from the Middle Ages, and books of food descriptions. All kinds of just weird things are expressed in poetry, because poetry is the main way to use the Persian language. If you could say the vast majority of our classical canon, maybe 60-70% of it is poetry. So what happens is whatever is in vogue or is an issue in the West at the time, there is an entryway via Persian poetry. So Khayyam has this kind of almost nihilism, but carpe diem, questioning religiosity. Well, is it any wonder that Victorian Brits, as secularism was taking hold, as they felt like the society was a bit too high strung, loved this idea of, look at this, these Oriental people who just have fun and they enjoy life and they live in the moment. So that was then. And then as Westerners got tired of that and said, you know, we're too secular now, we need spirituality, but we don't really like Protestantism anymore. So what's out there? Rumi comes in as the kind of main spiritual figure of the East, if I can say, more than the Buddhas and all that. No one has a bigger work, a more impactful work than the Masnavi. right? In terms of how far it spread, how many people read it, how many languages it was translated into, how deep it is, if I can say as a biased person. So then Rumi kicked in. And then maybe in 10 or 15 years, if there's some other trend, some other poet will have some material to speak to that moment. Right now, we're covering this poet. She is an early modern Iranian feminist poet. And she describes women's issues and the life of Iranian women with, you know, very passionate detail, very reflective person. So there's something for everyone, for the traditionalist, for the feminist, for the religious person, for the atheist. Every idea has some sort of deep poetic expression. And that's why I fell in love with it, ultimately. So who knows why a particular person becomes famous at a particular time. There's a bit of luck and randomness, but I think this Rumi and Khayyam won't be the only ones. That going forward, we'll see more cases.
Well, one question that a lot of people have, may have, or they just won't know. You said Rumi was a Sufi, right? Now, Sufism is a kind of weird type of Islam, but do you want to explain a little bit? Like, what is a Sufi?
Sure. Broadly speaking, there are Muslims who are concerned with the mystical and inner spiritual dimension of Islam, as opposed to the outer dimension that maybe people are more familiar with, such as the way you look and the hijab and prayer and, you know, particular notions of legalism and law and morality. So not to say they don't have those things. Rumi lived in the 1200s in the Muslim world. That stuff is familiar to him, certainly, and he lived that out. But he ultimately understood that those things are incidental. So how law looks, you know, Muslims in the West are talking about Sharia, Sharia, Sharia. Well, that's just governing human relations, and it changes with time. And how fashion looks, you know, those things change with time. There was a time when women covered their hair differently, and maybe they will cover it differently in the future. And all these things that we, you know, worry about and kvetch about regarding Islam, these are all things that change with time and place. But that which is undying, that is the same always, is that spiritual dimension. And that's ultimately what religion's about, right? Religion, the least of its important duties is to govern public morality or to create structure. The most important part of religion is the internal part. And the way you know that is because secularism has replaced everything but that. We have secular laws. We have secular notions of dress and morality. You know, we have laws against murder without invoking the Bible or the Quran or the Torah. But what we can't do is have a spirituality that is devoid of religious content. In Sufism, I can get into all the historical, political contexts that emerge. We could have a 10-hour lecture series. But what I would say is it emerged in a specific time and place when certain people realized that that was not necessarily expressed well or clearly in Islam as it was understood then. So certain people in 10th century Iraq, in Khorasan, in northeastern Iran, and Iraq then was part of Iran's cultural sphere. These mostly Persian people started to express these spiritual ideas in the lens of Islam, and then that crystallized into what we would call Sufism.
Yeah, I mean, is it fair to say that, I mean, this is not an exact analogy, but it's like, you know, in Christianity, you get like the mystics or the Gnostics, you know, which are different, they're not part of the kind of main line of, they're none of the main branch, they're kind of an esoteric form. Or in Judaism, I think it's Kabbalah, something like this. Was it fair to say that Sufism is in a similar ballpark, that it's a kind of esoteric strand of Islam, as opposed to, you know, you're not going to go to a mosque and have like a Sufi preacher, say?
Those comparisons are correct, but the degree of how niche they are is very different. So unlike Gnosticism and Kabbalah, which were always very niche, Sufism did in certain times and places enjoy very broad appeal. And it really, in the Muslim world, comes down to this one phrase in Arabic, "Anas al-Din Mulukihim." People are upon the religion of their king. So to make a Western example, Roman Empire says, oh, we're Christian now. Well, slowly we'll all be Christianized. And similarly, in the Muslim world, it really depends who the Sultan is. So in Rumi's day, the Sultan loved Rumi, so his movement had a lot of currency where he lived, and he had broad freedom to preach and teach the masses. And other times, they were not happy about mysticism, so it went underground. So I would say there were times when it was as sidelined as the Gnostics and the Kabbalah, but there were other moments in time where Sufism actually even represented the majority understanding, that it actually had a widespread, broad kind of presence where you could actually go to a mosque and the preacher is a Sufi. Not in all times and places, but in some times and some places it would have been.
Now, given that we're talking about poetry, why don't we, like, if you're willing, why don't we hear some, why don't you pick like a favorite Rumi?
Yeah, I would love to do that. Yeah, absolutely. So I can't say this is my absolute favorite, but if I could only express one thing, it would be the opening of Rumi's Masnavi, his magnum opus, the very first lines, which have been debated and pondered endlessly, where he says, Bishno in nay chun shikayat mikonad, as judai ha hikayat mikonad. Hear from this reed flute as it renders complaints. It tells stories of separations. So Rumi opens his Masnavi comparing himself to the reed flute, which was an instrument that featured heavily, prominently in his mystical gatherings, along with the drum and other stringed instruments. Rumi compares himself to the reed, something that has been torn away from its homeland, right, where they grow, and by the water, probably in kind of shallow waters. And it's been hollowed out. It's been emptied of its contents, of its insides. And that's a metaphor for the process of the mystic emptying his ego out. And then it's been tortured by being drilled into and heated and cured, which is, again, the pain and the pangs of this mystical process. And then finally, after being tortured and disrooted and all of these things, it can cry out and have this beautiful lament, which hearkens to the divine, which wakes up the slumbering masses. And that is the first two lines that opens the Masnavi of Rumi. And he goes on for the next 18. I have a whole class about this opening. He goes on for the next 18 lines telling us about the pains of the flute, saying, since they tore me away from the reed bed, women and men have cried into my cry, have played me. But I really desire, more than just being an instrument, is a chest that has been torn apart from longing, so that we may commiserate in the pain of this separation. Because whoever has been torn away from his origin yearns to again return and be united with that origin. And even though in every group I go and I cry, sometimes happily like at weddings, sometimes in a sad moment like a funeral, and even though every person who hears my lament or my joyous song thinks that they are one with me, that they understand me, there is a secret I have that can even be heard in my cries, but that the masses do not possess the illumination to understand. And your body, O listener, is not far from your soul, but you have not, maybe you can say, cultivated yourself such that you can perceive the soul. And the fire that I blow out is not hot air. And whoever does not understand this fire, does not possess this fire, will never fully understand what I'm speaking about. And he goes on and personifies this flute. And then he moves into the first story, which is of a king who falls in love with a slave girl who becomes sick. And then for 50,000 more lines, Rumi brings anecdote after story after parable to talk about the human condition. And it's even deeper when you think about the life Rumi was living. Rumi was uprooted. He was a refugee. He lived during the Mongol invasion. You know, maybe Europeans haven't experienced anything as crazy as the Mongols. We're just a small group of nomads, horde from the steppes, descend and destroy your civilization. I mean, think about the barbarians at Rome, something like that. And Rumi is living in this time where his town is depopulated and everyone is killed. And he goes to Konya, the farthest extent of Islamdom, which was the declining Byzantine Empire. Rumi is living in like the last kind of breaths of the Romans. And he's living almost as a stranger in this Roman surrounding, as a refugee. And he's having these deepest observances of the human condition. It's really a remarkable work that deserves more study. And it's a shame that because of the time and place and the language that it comes from, it's not widely known in the world today.
Fascinating. And even from that brief kind of excerpt, you can, those people in the audience who have, let's say, a kind of spiritual leaning or understanding, would be able to pick out, you know, some of the things that he's getting at already. Just before we wrap up here, we've talked a lot about Rumi. Who are some of the other Persian poets, you know, if people can check out? I mentioned a couple at the start, but who would you point people towards, you know, as a very basic introduction?
I'll start by saying Ferdowsi. You can't not mention him, but it may be hard for a non-Iranian audience to grasp how significant he is to us. So his stories of our ancient kings, some real, some mythologized, some semi-mythologized, they have not really been translated that well. There's one by an English gentleman, Dick Davis, but it's not fully in poetry. It's more of a prose translation, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention him. Attar has the Conference of the Birds, which is a very famous, maybe it's something like Rumi's Masnavi, but it has a continuous timeline of events. It's more of like a understandable story with parables thrown in to explain the spiritual lessons along the way. And it's very famous and well-known now in English. And then Rumi, of course, I have a book, I have classes. He has a Masnavi, and then he has an entire other work of just lyric poems that are written in a format that is more resembling maybe a Shakespearean sonnet. And in that same vein, Hafez is another very famous poet. I also have a weekly Hafez class. So a weekly Rumi class. We meet once a week for an hour on Sunday morning and we read Rumi together. And then on Saturday mornings, the day before, we read from Hafez's, we can call them sonnets, but they're called ghazals in Persian. Hafez lives in a very interesting moment. He also lives through tumult and instability. He lives through Tamerlane's time. He has a lot of reflections on Islamic Iranian society, a lot of criticisms. He's a scathing critic. He's a bit of a libertine as well. He's also a very deep thinker and a Gnostic, actually. The poems you read today were kind of almost explicitly Christian. He says in one line, if the grace of the Holy Spirit gives us, you know, help again, others can too heal like the Messiah once healed. So Hafez is actually kind of a Gnostic and more than a Sufi. People call him Sufi. He's more properly kind of in that Gnostic tradition, believe it or not, even though he's in medieval Iran. Sa'di is a great humorist and moralist. He has very good basic life advices, a book that from ages 5 to 50 would just help you approach life. He has all kinds of little quips and tales. And he says, learn from the failings of others, lest you become proverbial for calamity. So Sa'di is a great moralist, but also has very beautiful love poems, very delicate love poems. I mean, there's so much. There's a whole wealth of information. Those are probably the most famous. We mentioned Fitzgerald's Khayyam. It's probably easy enough to get a hold of that. But if I had to say just four works to read, would be the Golestan of Sa'di, full of aphorisms and tales, maybe like Aesop in a way. The Divan of Hafez, which Dick Davis has a good translation of, and the Mantiroter of Attar. Now, these three that I've mentioned are all relatively short. The last one that I admit is a bit much to get into is the Masnavi of Rumi, which is what I read from. Now, there's another Brit who has an excellent translation of the whole thing into iambic pentameter, taking a bit of inspiration from Shakespeare, believe it or not. So there is also that published by Oxford World Classics. So if you had, I don't know, if you wanted to dedicate 100 hours to truly grasp the Persianate tradition, if you read those books, I think you would get a good sampling of our wisdom and our soul, maybe you can say.
Now, I have to admit, whenever I've tried to get into Hafez, I haven't got a clue what he's talking about. I mean, and I'm a literary professor of literature, you know, but he's very cryptic. You know, it'd be like, oh, there's a woman sitting under a tree. There's a woman sitting under a tree and I have a sip of wine and then the sun goes down. Oh, right. I haven't got a clue. You know what I mean? Like there's this kind of mysterious element to a lot of his poems.
There is. They're living in a culture that is very, and this is very Muslim and Jewish and not so much Protestant. Protestantism is very much characterized by, you know, you can make a new church and grab your Bible and there you go, have at it, pal. Maybe Catholics would a little bit relate to this, but even still, not so much. It's again, very Eastern thing of this obsession with heterodoxy and squashing it, which is also has laid the seeds of a lot of our lack of development, unfortunately, because we have a society where everyone conforms ideologically. You never come up with new ideas. So Hafez is kind of like this Gnostic, semi-heretical person who's expressing ideas in a very cryptic way. So we read a poem that mentions the, and maybe I'll just briefly read one line of it, that mentions the Gnostic elements of Hafez. And it's just so hard to even grasp, even now scholars debate, what exactly is Hafez even saying here? Because again, remember, he's kind of has a knife on his throat. He lives under a real religious dictatorship in the form of a guy named Mubarez ad-Din. Literally, his name means the fighter of the religion. And they called him in secret the religious morals officer, like we have in Iran today. because he would just go around killing people for heresy. He just loved the idea of killing heretics. I think he said he personally beheaded 100 people. So he says, for years, I sought the goblet of Jamshid, which is like the Holy Grail in Persian literature. For years, I sought the goblet of Jamshid. I sought within strangers that which was in my heart. Last night, I took my problem to the Magian elder, the Zoroastrian mage. And he, with his glance, would solve riddles and mysteries. I said, who gave you this goblet that reveals the world? And when did the wise one give it to you? So Hakim, wise one, is a very Gnostic way of referring to God, like the Hagia Sophia, right? The famous Orthodox basilicas are called the Great Wisdom or something like that. He said, the day he made this blue dome, meaning the firmament, I was bestowed this goblet that has everlasting divine wisdom. And even though he could not make God out with his eyes, he always, quote unquote, made God. So he goes on and he has this discourse, and it ends with saying, if the divine abundance, you can say, of the Holy Spirit again assists us, then others too can do what the Messiah did with his hands, approximately. So this discourse, you think, so is he a Muslim? Is he a Gnostic? He's talking about this everlasting goblet of wine that was made on the day the firmament was created, and the Gnostic has it, and it's hidden under his cloak. What does that even mean? You know, and then other places, he seems like a devout Muslim. So is he dissimulating there in those poems? Like, hey, Mubarak-Zedin, here's my poem that proves I'm like an Orthodox believer, not a heretic. Then he has this other one where he says, if the Holy Spirit helps us, the Messiah will again heal us. Like, what is he saying here?
Yeah. Anyway. So fascinating stuff. Well, if people want to know more, you have your courses there. You have your website, which I encourage people to check out. You're always posting interesting stuff on your Twitter feed, which is how I found you. I'll just remind people to pick up courses at the academic agency, of course. And yeah, we may be seeing each other again pretty soon.
I hope so. Thank you.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just 3 of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.